Namaskaram. My name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Leaving my mark and being someone in this country, like, and I wanted to show that, hey, you know what? When I came here, I was nobody.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 47 with Vedangi Kulkarni. I met Vedangi for the first time virtually in the middle of lockdown when she asked me if I'd answer some questions for a course she's running about planning adventures and expeditions. We got on really well and I was keen to turn it all around and get her on the podcast. To be completely honest, I might have overlooked Vedangi initially. We like to have people on the podcast who've done incredible things or lived full lives and, importantly, have had time to reflect on everything. But something just felt right sitting down to record with Vedangi. I could tell that she'd really put some thought into what she's been through over the last 3 years, and I was fascinated by her attitude, maybe even more so given her youth. The final green light for me was when she told me that she was planning on cycling to the place where we were recording. I jumped on Google Maps and worked out it was a 100-mile journey, so it doesn't get any more real than that. So, Vedangi, she's 21 years old and has cycled around the world. She'll tell you the story herself, but she built up to that challenge in the 4 or 5 years before with a series of misadventures and hugely steep learning curves. In this episode, we deep dive into not just the how, which is amazing in and of itself, but also the why. So over to Vedangi Kulkarni. Thank you, first of all, for sitting down and doing this.
Thank you for inviting me.
And cycling all that way.
Oh man, it was fun. I think I wouldn't rather have had it any other way. I'm glad I rode here because it gave me some time with myself, to gain composure, to think, and yeah. Like earlier you said, to be myself, and I think like now I truly can because I rode my bike here.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know about like that. Maybe I should start riding my bike places. Okay, so I think a great place to start, especially with you and your background, is where did you grow up and what sort of child were you and what were your surroundings, what were you exposed to and what were your passions?
I grew up in India in a place called Pune. Well, Pune is a city, but I grew up in the outskirts, and my parents have always been like super supportive with everything I do, and my dad always worked abroad, so he used to be like 28 days in the middle of some ocean and 28 days in the house basically, and when he used to be in the house we used to talk about going places, doing things, and we used to go on hikes because Pune is kind of on a plateau and there's quite a few mountains around somewhere. And yeah, so it was really cool. But I think the school I went to was quite religious. Well, but I never believed in God, so I always got in a bit of trouble with that. And I always, like, I didn't go with the culture, if that makes sense. So I was always the girl who made friends with boys when you're not supposed to do that. I was always the girl who played football with the guys when, I don't know, the girls were spending their PT just sitting and doing nothing. And I was not good at sports. I wasn't great at football. I just wanted to make friendships. I just wanted to, you know, fit in, because somehow hanging around with my female classmates I didn't feel like I fit in. I had nothing to talk about, and I just felt like this boring slob, and I was just like, oh, what am I doing with my life? And most of my school life, obviously, I didn't have many friends. I was always the one who kind of, you know, went somewhere and ate their lunch alone, sort of thing. But sometimes I would just, you know, hang around with the guys and play football, and that's how I somehow got into semi-professional football. And yeah, I was playing for a team, a club called Pune FC, Pune Football Club, and I knew they were big, and I knew they were starting a female team, and I don't know how I got selected. I went for the trials, and I was their number one goalkeeper, and I'm not gonna lie, as a goalkeeper, your job is to be commanding. You're in charge. You have the whole field to yell at if they do something wrong and all that. And yeah, I wasn't commanding. I was none of that. And I always felt like I didn't really like... I always felt like the other girls in the team didn't really like me. And I hate to say this, but I was a pushover. I can't help it. So if someone asked me to do something, even if it wasn't my job, I would do it. But the reason I was a goalkeeper, and the reason I chose to be one, and the reason I, at the time, felt like I was a good one, because I was not scared. I've broken my nose several times. I had braces which literally went through my, like, lips several times from the inside, and I've been injured far too many times in my head and, like, just my face, basically. And I've never been scared. Like, I love just, you know, diving for the ball and just going for it. And I think that's why I chose to play football in the first place. And when I was 17, I kind of realized, right, I am playing football, but I'm not really enjoying the whole team dynamics right now. I'd love to do something just by myself. And that's how it started. When I say it, I mean, like, the whole, you know, cycling, long distances, mountains, doing something new, being by myself, all of that. That started, like, when I decided that the whole team dynamics and football and goalkeeping wasn't working anymore. But yeah, that's when I went on a really short kind of camp, a summer camp-like thing, which was only for, what, less than a week. And you were supposed to cycle, what, 60 kilometers with a group of people. And me and my ex-boyfriend went there. And I was 17 at the time, yeah. And that ride was I met some really amazing people who have spent far too much time in the mountains there. And they were the ones who suggested that, you're like, because I kept kind of going ahead of the group, or I just wanted to ride by myself or just with my ex. And yeah, that was literally how the trip leaders, sort of thing. They were like, hey, you could do a longer ride. There is actually a route that goes across the Himalayas. It's called, you can go from Manali to Leh, and Leh is in Jammu and Kashmir, in Ladakh region. Manali is in Himachal Pradesh, and yeah, and then there's another route which goes to Srinagar, and they were like, you can do the whole thing. And I was like, oh, I can do the whole thing. Oh, I want to do the whole thing. But Yeah, I really diverted there right now. Like, oh, you asked me about how I grew up, and I literally went all the way from there to talking about the Himalayan ride.
No, that's perfect. That's exactly where we were going with this. I mean, so what made you, you know, you said, oh yeah, I want to do that ride. I want to go and cycle that long route. What was the appeal? What was the draw?
The appeal was that people do it in groups, and the group organizers didn't want me to go with the groups because I was under 18, and for insurance purposes, or I don't know, maybe I was just a liability, which they didn't want to take. So yeah, I said to my dad that I want to do it alone. And the minute he said yes, I was like, hell yeah, like, you're my man. Yeah, I want to do that then. Okay. And then there was a but. He was like, but me and your mom don't want you to do it like all by yourself. How about we jump in a car and we wouldn't be directly behind you. We will be 10, 15 kilometers somewhere around. But yeah, you will get your time and you will get to do what you want to. But we will do what we want to and be like, you know, in 15 kilometers radius. And if something goes wrong, we'll be there. And it was legit because, like, you could see that I didn't have much muscle in my body. I was skinny, like, I was little. Like, what did I know, you know? I'd still say that, what do I know? And yeah, it was fine. And the altitude, on the very first day, I faced altitude sickness. So, like, yeah, that was legit for them to want to be around. And yeah, the day I started, like, I think the whole appeal that you asked me was the fact that I was going to do it by myself and so many people do it in groups. That was one. And second one was that the first time I went in the mountains, I bloody loved it. And I was like, it feels so nice to be in the middle of such huge, I don't know, and beautiful mountains. And like every time I looked around, I forgot that I had anything to worry about. And I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. And I knew the climbs were hard, and I knew it was just going to get harder because the altitude increased with the further along I went in the route, the altitude only increased. So it was going to be hard. And yeah, I knew that, but I was kind of like I felt like with leaving football, I was kind of, you know, I was leaving everything in half. So before that, I used to do yoga as well professionally, and I left that. Then I left that, and I was like, come on, like, I need to see what I can do. I think I never pushed past a threshold, and that's what I'm never finding out. And I thought, yeah, maybe that's my time, I should try. And then I was kind of like, you know, not much can go wrong. And someone had said to me that the mountains will take care of you. And this person had repeated that to me a lot of times. And I was like, okay, we'll see. yeah, and that was the whole appeal that, you know, let's see what I can do and if I can push past that threshold.
And just quickly before, because I have a lot of questions to ask you about that, can you describe, you know, for people who haven't been to that part of the world, who are trying to sort of formulate a picture and an idea of what that looks like and what you're cycling along, you know, is it roads in the valleys, is it mountain passes, what's the ground like, and what does everything look like?
So it's, yeah, there's some roads through valleys, and Indus River is very fast flowing right alongside, and it's like a very, very like blue river, and more often than not, it's sunny, at least when I went. And the roads are tarmac, when you're lucky. When you're not, it's worse than fire roads at a bike park. And the climbs are steep, some of them. And the altitude is... the place where I started was 5,000 feet. And on day one, where I was supposed to climb to, was at 11,200 feet, oh, wow. I believe. So you can see, like, and the distance between that was only 32 kilometers.
And so hang on, at this point, how much training have you done?
I have, my longest ride was 100 miles as training, and that was when a mentor, which I met in the mountains, he suggested that there is this hill station close to our place, and he was like, well, when I say close, it's 100 miles, like, on the dot, and he was like, just leave from your house and ask your parents to, like, and actually, and even if I said I wanted to do it by myself, my parents would want to jump in a car. And they did, obviously. And yeah, it was really shit. Like, honestly, the first ride, I had never rode over 50 kilometers, I believe. And that was going to be 100 miles. That's 160 kilometers. And I was like, holy shit, how am I going to do that? And it was a very, very hot day. And the road was full of cars and loads of traffic. And there's two mini mountain passes before you go to, like, the massive one. And they're, like, very short. 5 kilometer climbs, both of them. And then the last climb is, I think, 10 or 11 kilometers. And I was scared. I was like, I'm going to need to stop often. And I didn't know the concept of recovering on the bike back then, because that was like my first long ride. And my parents kept telling me that every 10 kilometers you should stop and have water. And I was like, no, I'm not going to stop in 10 kilometers. Like, I'm going to do at least what my longest ride has been so far before I stop, so that I can, you know, really see what I'm able to do. And yeah, I was like, okay, the minute I reached the 50 kilometer mark, I was like, okay, I have to go at least 5 kilometers more to prove to myself that I can do this.
Oh, interesting.
So 5 kilometers more, and there was this small, we call it Dhaba. Dhaba is a very, it's not a restaurant, it's not a cafe. It's a tiny open place with a little shelter. And yeah, it's like someone's cooking on an open thing, and it's not very safe, like. But yeah, I stopped there and I ate something, and I was like, wow, this is the longest one I've done. And I have more than that to do again. So I was like, okay, maybe I can do the distance I've done now and then stop. And I learned that I'm actually able to do this. And the worst part was when the cars overtook and all that, because I was just like, oh, what's happening with me? And I didn't have a very good road bike. I had a cheap hybrid, and yeah, it's like £100 bike. It's not a very great bike. I say that now. At the time, I was like, oh my God, I have such an amazing bike. And it is amazing, I still have it. But that ride, every climb I did, I had an aim of stopping only once on the climb. I was like, okay, I will allow myself to stop only once. And it worked on the 5 kilometers one, on the big climb that I said, the 10, 11 kilometers one, I had to stop twice. And I was like,
why not my thing. Why set the rules so strict for yourself?
I really wanted to do the Himalayan ride, and I wanted to show my parents that I am capable of it. And I know they've never put any pressure on me like that, but a part of me wanted to show them as well as myself that, look, you're not shit. You can ride bike, and you can, if you can climb this, then the next climb you will find easier, because you already have this in your head. And if you stop only once, then you will know that you've stopped only once, and the next time you do it, you will not want to stop at all. So I know that the more I do something, the less I'll want to stop, the less I'll want to kind of, I'll make it harder for myself as I go, just because somehow I will feel like I'm getting stronger. And just for that feeling of getting stronger, I stopped myself from stopping the climbs.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most interesting things about this for me is, you know, so many people, particularly young people, suffer with, you know, imposter syndrome and a total lack of confidence. Whereas, you know, you seem as though you just thought, oh, I can do that. Where did that come from, do you think?
I think the fact that I had nothing to compare to really worked well, and not once did my parents say that you haven't got it in you. They've always been like, you can do this, because the year before that, or the 2 years before that, I had done a bungee jump, and it was from a 120 meter tower, and my dad always, even now, uses this as an example, and he's like, you stood on that tower and you jumped with just a rope tied to your feet, like, you can do anything you want. So it compares everything to that, and I think that really helped, because I was kind of like, I haven't spoken to many other people about this, and the only people I've spoken to have told me I can do this, and I haven't seen anyone kind of, you know, I haven't seen anyone my age do it yet, so why not try and see what I can do? So I was kind of like, I think it worked really well that I was surrounded with positive people, and yeah, that was that.
Yeah, I mean, incredibly supportive parents. That's amazing. Yeah. And
hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, try not to get bogged down in all of this too much, but it's really interesting. Would you say that were you seeking adventure, or were you just wanting to find a way to challenge yourself?
I was doing both. I was seeking an adventure by challenging myself, because my definition of adventure is kind of, it falls within the whole, you know, outdoors challenge by myself, and something that I haven't, like, an experience that I haven't had before, or I'm pushing past a fear, and, you know, stuff like that. So I think that's how it kind of went for me. It was both. It was always, I was looking for an adventure. And I've always been very specific with my own definition of adventure. I've always been like, I'll talk to other people about what they think is an adventure, but I'll decide what it means for me. And I think that's worked really well so far.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about it, is that it's so subjective.
Yeah, definitely.
And we all have our own version. So how old were you when you did that?
That weird 100-mile ride?
Yeah, and the Himalaya ride.
17.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so what was the journey? What was that Himalayan journey? How long was it?
It was supposed to be like 100... Oh, sorry. It was supposed to be 1,000 to 1,200 kilometers long. It was cut down to 800 because at one point the Indian Army thought that I shouldn't proceed to go to Srinagar, because at the time there were some riots going on, and riots in Kashmir region of India are really, really bad. Like, they were throwing pellets at... shooting pellets, yeah, that's the word. They were shooting pellets at teenagers who were protesting against, I'm not sure what, but they were like militants, and it was a bad situation. And I'm not gonna lie, I was not happy about the fact that I wasn't gonna be able to proceed. I cried a lot about that, and then my dad was like, look, you're gonna do bigger things, like, you know, don't stress too much about it. But then the reason it hurt so much, the fact that I couldn't continue, was because in the journey, in whatever 800 kilometers that I had done, there was a mountain pass. It's called Lachingla or something. And there are 21 hairpin bends. And I had no idea that after the 21 hairpin bends, there is a 5-kilometer climb to the mountain pass. So I've always worked, like, I had learned by then, this was in the bang in the middle of the whole, like, journey, and I'd learned by then that I had to conserve energy, there's that, and I was doing fine with the Gata loops. I was really enjoying the hairpin bends. And got to the end, like the top one. And I don't know what happened. I was struggling to breathe. And my dad has a very bad case of asthma. Just then, the vehicle passed. And the driver, he was obviously... They don't take tourists seriously. They just think, like, even if you're trained, even if you're a bloody athlete, they wouldn't believe that you will be okay if you just kept going on. So this driver made a big deal out of me struggling, and then he made a big deal about my dad, who was genuinely having an asthma attack. And he was like, okay, we need to get medical help for him. We need to get you in the car, blah, blah. And I was just like, but I can go. I can walk, but I can go, you know? Like, and at that point, I wasn't walking. I was still on the bike, and I was going at a ridiculous speed. I think I was going at like 3 or 5 kilometers per hour. And I'm slow on uphills, but my aim is always to just get over the mountain. I'm never about going fast. And this guy was like, yeah, get in the car. And the minute I got in, and it was that mountain pass that my bike was in the car, and it was like a little section of the big route. And bear in mind, like, that little section, I cried so much about it. I called my mentor. I was just like, Dad, are you sure you're having an asthma attack? The next day, I woke up and realized I was being incredibly selfish. It's like, that man is still in the car and he still wants me to ride. And just for one mountain pass, which I couldn't finish, I'm making such a fuss about it. Like, why? Like, I don't need to, like, I realized then, like, the next day or a few days after, that I didn't need to prove to anyone. This was for myself, and this was for, you know, this was to see what I can do. And it's okay that my dad was having troubles with breathing, I was having troubles with breathing. It's okay, and I cannot be so selfish.
What an amazing lesson to learn.
Yeah, definitely. Lois, lesson learned the hard way. Like, no one said a thing. My parents were actually... Well, mum not so much, but my dad was actually like, get on your bike, keep going, do this and all that. So he was all in for me going forwards and doing this. But I was just like, and he didn't say that you're being selfish. He didn't say that I was, you know, I was just kind of making a big fuss about it. It was just me who realized, like, a couple of days later that... when I was riding bike, actually, I was doing the highest motorable pass, which is not the highest, by the way. It's they say it's an 18,500 feet or something, but it's not. It's not. It's on 17,800 or something. Yeah, I didn't know that.
That's PR.
No, I went on the top of the climb, and it says highest motorable pass in the world, and it says the altitude, and then I looked up on Wikipedia and it was wrong, and I was like, oh damn it, now I have to go find the highest. But I don't care that much, but I just did it to see if I could do it, and I could, so that was fine. But yeah, yeah, came down after that. So the way it goes is, like, the route passes from Manali, and then there is a mountain pass called Rotangla. It's around 13,000 feet. Then there is a pass called Baralacha. And that is, like, it gets proper cold there, because you're in the middle of this whole... You're in the middle of the biggest mountains that this valley has to offer. And the pass itself, it's so long to climb up that. And... once you're over, because it's cold over there, and because the weather really gets bad over there quite often, you just find hard to breathe, basically. But anyway, yeah, that pass was quite hard. And then you go down, and then you do the loops that I mentioned earlier, and then that pass, and then there's another pass, and then you reach Leh. And the city of Leh is, like, the center of Ladakh. I think is the only city in Ladakh region, and it's really like this. I would have thought that there wouldn't be many people there because it's based on 3,000 meters. So like yeah, I was kind of like, who's gonna be like, you know, around there? But it's a proper city, like London. No, well, not like London, let's say like Swindon or something. It's quite big. And then from there you go up to this pass, and it's a 40-kilometer climb. So you go from 3,000 meters to 5,200 meters. I'm getting my maths wrong, but something like that. It's a proper big climb, and it's really fun. And then the route towards Srinagar is like a completely different road. And this whole road that I did was covered with, the road was full of army trucks. And the people in the Indian Army are the kindest people. Like, you stop at the side of the road, and if they see you alone, they stop and they ask if you want water. They stop and they ask if you have enough food. And obviously, I didn't have many bags on my bike. I only had one on my back. So they stopped and asked if I had enough of everything, if I had a change of clothes, if I had, you know, enough things to keep me warm and all that. And they're so amazing. Like, and there was a point in our journey where I didn't have a place to camp, basically, because there was nothing open or nothing there. And an army truck, like, and there was one space left in the place where we could camp. We thought it was all taken. There was one space left, and there was this guy from the army who was gonna go in and stay there because he had it booked or something. I don't know what it was, but we had a chat just before we went in, and he said that he said, like, you know, you don't look too old. How old are you? What are you doing? Blah blah. And I told him that, oh yeah, I'm Dangi. I come from Pune. I'm riding from Manali to Leh and then to Srinagar, and I'm looking for a place to sleep. I'm really tired. Today has been a bad day. And so he just, like, he got me some tea, and we had a proper chat about everything, about life. And my parents were some, like, they hadn't got there yet. And this guy gives up his space in the place, and that was going to be his first warm night's sleep, not in an army truck. And he gives up his space for me. And I was like, oh. I was like, oh, that is amazing. Like, I didn't ask for it, but it just happened. And I think that was the lesson that, you know, I didn't know what the lesson was. But what I mean is, like, I learned then that sometimes things, good things just happen, and, like, just accept it when it did.
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, plan for the best, plan for the worst and hope for the best. And you usually, whilst we always have to be wary, you can often, when traveling, rely on the kindness of strangers.
Yeah.
More
yeah.
often than not.
Definitely. Yeah. That's always been my favourite.
So, forgive my naivety, but, you know, culturally in India, is it a normal thing to see a 17-year-old young woman out on a solo adventure?
No. In fact, like, that wasn't a normal thing. A lot of things that I've done ever since I was a child haven't been quite normal. So, like, me wanting to go out and climb mountains, like, I was quite a lot into, like, mountaineering, long-distance hiking and all that, and that is not normal. And it's always been because my dad has wanted to go on adventures for a long, long time, and he never got a chance because he did chemical engineering and he started working abroad in oil and gas and all that. And because of that, he never got a chance to do all these things. But as his daughter, he always has wanted me to have the most adventurous life. And he's always wanted me to do what I really like to do. And that's also not normal. So when I decided that I wanted to study abroad and do sports management, it was not a good thing because everyone was like, sports management? Like, you don't get jobs in that. Because, like, anything in sports, adventure, all that is not a thing in India. You either could do medical or you do engineering or you become a lawyer or something. Like, literally, there aren't many options, and even if there are options, they aren't open to everybody. And it's hard, like, to choose something different. And my dad always was like, he told me that, you know, a lot of things that you do, they don't fall under the normal in our country. And that's why when you go to the UK, try not to come back. he said that to me on the airport. He was like, make sure you actually, like, you know, do something good out there. Don't come back. And I was like, okay.
I mean, that's, you know, obviously he's so supportive and quite clearly a wonderful man. But that's a really sad thing to have to say to your daughter.
It is. But then they aren't in India right now anyway. They are in Oman. And they wanted to, like... Yeah, it is a sad thing to have to say to his daughter. But he saw the way I was living my life. He saw, like, I wanted to be alone. I wanted to do all those things by myself. And my parents always tried to, like, give me that space, but also not leave me completely alone. Like, I'm still saying about this, like, Himalayan ride. But even when I was back in India after doing what? Like 25,000 kilometers or so, even then my parents didn't agree with actually letting me do it all by myself. I mean, imagine, like, because on daily basis you read the news about women getting raped, getting murdered, you see the news about really horrible things happening, riots happening, like Hindus fighting with Muslims and all that, and It's crazy. It's kind of like people do things by themselves, but they do get in trouble, and it's not nice. And because my parents are very aware of that, and they don't want me to get in trouble that much, that's why Dad was like, look, it will be safer in the Western countries. I laugh about that because in Spain that thing happened and I didn't tell him for days because I was like, yeah, you know how, like the way I started the conversation about Spain to tell my dad was when I was back on the bike and I was like, hey dad, you know how you said Western countries are safe? Ah, here's what happened to me.
Yeah, we'll come on to that, I think. So, I mean, really interesting. I mean, now that you're living full-time in the UK, do you...
Almost.
Almost.
Yeah, my visa is underway. And, well, I've got a provisional visa, but there's a residence permit that you usually get, which I haven't got yet.
Okay, well, yeah, see how that plays out. Here's hoping.
Mm. No, it will come. It's just a matter of time. It's fine.
Yeah. Do you miss India?
I do not miss where I grew up, but I miss knowing that I was a train ride or a flight away from, you know, going to the Himalayas, because I used to go there almost every summer. Yeah, almost. And I quite, like, miss that, but I'm not going to lie, the fact that I didn't have many friends growing up meant that I could disengage myself from that place pretty quickly when I came to the UK, which didn't really work in my favor because I didn't know a single person when I moved here. So I was like, I felt properly lonely. Like, I used to either call my mentor, who actually, like, encouraged me and gave me the route and, like, basically taught me everything I know about endurance cycling. I either spoke to him about, hey, maybe I could do some big routes or big adventures in the UK on those lines. Or I would speak with my parents, and I found it really hard to make friends.
Yeah, I mean, how difficult was that transition then?
Let's say I was at a point when I just came here. For a few months at least, I was going on really long rides over the night and stuff, not knowing the rules of how the roads work or anything. I would basically be reckless because, in a way, I was like, nothing to lose sort of thing. And that's a very bad place to be. Like, honestly, that's not a great place to be.
So yeah. You got here and you just started cycling?
Yeah, the day I came, within the first few hours. And it was really crazy. I came down, obviously I had a big suitcase, I had a rucksack and I had bike box. And obviously I couldn't carry all of it by myself, especially the bike box. You do need two hands to do it. And there was this big bus from university and a few volunteers who had come to receive us. And someone forgot one of the volunteers offered to take my suitcase, and he forgot it in the train thing. And it was insane. And I was like, I don't even know his name. I don't know anybody here. And my phone doesn't have a SIM card. And I'm just like, and I had a really shitty phone. The Wi-Fi didn't connect properly on it and everything. And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I here? And it was literally within the first hour of getting here. I was really struggling with life already. Got in the bus to Bournemouth, and I clearly remember I had a very, very thick Indian accent, and I really found it hard to understand the British accent, or like, I don't know what the accent of the person talking to me then was, but I just found it really hard to understand, and I was like, this makes for an awkward conversation. And I went back. I stopped at Bournemouth train station, or just opposite that, with all of the bags and everything. And a friend of friend of friend of dad or something like that, a really, like, I think friend of friend or something of my dad's, him and his wife came to, like, they came there, and I haven't spoken to those people since. But anyway, they came there and they got into a taxi, got us a taxi, went to my accommodation, which was a homestay, which is not a great thing. Like, honestly, I don't know why I chose to stay in a homestay for my first year. Like, I wanted to make friends, but that was the hardest place to make friends, because the landlord at the same place and his daughter was a proper brat who made really racist comments at me. I don't even know if she knew it, but she was a teenager, like 13, 14. And I was just like, oh God. And he didn't like my bike or my bikes later on. And within the first few hours, I literally put my bike together. And I said goodbye to the people who had got the taxi, because they didn't introduce me properly to the place. They were more like, oh, we're from London, Bournemouth is a small place, we don't know how to deal with this sort of thing. And they were quite fancy, and they were just like, they were treating me like a child, and I was like, fuck off. Oh, like, you know, don't treat me like a child. Anyway, I didn't really get along with them, and I don't think they liked me either, because we haven't spoken since. But the first thing I did that day was go on a ride. And, you know, I went to uni, and I was just like, I wasn't using maps to do that. So I wasn't using digital maps. I would ask people. I was like, okay, maybe this is how I can know the area, because I'll talk to locals. And I tried that. Apparently it doesn't work that well in the UK, but whatever. It did at the time, but yeah. Within the few months of getting to the UK, I decided I was going to ride my bike across the country, which was bizarre. I still didn't understand the whole roads and where I can ride and where I cannot properly. I knew the M roads were the ones I cannot ride on. And I was kind of like, I can ride on A roads, but then there are roads like A31, which goes to London, and it's like a dual carriageway. And I was like, huh, if there are lorries, there are lorries. Like, you know, it's an A road, I can ride here. And yeah, then there was a police car asked me to get off and all that. That didn't go well. But I've also, like, I learned it the hard way that you're not supposed to ride on an M road, because I didn't check. I rode 50 kilometers on M3/M27, the one that goes from Southampton to Ringwood and to Bournemouth, and yeah, it didn't end well. Like, yeah, people kept honking. I was like, but then I was quite happy because there's hard shoulder, and I was like, oh, that's like a bike lane.
It's a very big
bike lane. I was like, oh, but I don't know why the bike lane has so many like glass pieces on it and so much like debris from the road, and yeah, never mind.
But then you said you cycled the length of the UK.
Well, I left from my house in Bournemouth, Boscombe, and I was just like, fuck it, I've carried what I can with me, and I didn't know what I was doing is called bike packing, so that was quite exciting. I had no idea what I was doing. I just had this Epidura saddlebag and a backpack. And I thought I was quite pro, honestly. No, I didn't know what I was doing. It was funny. I left, and within, I think I was like 110, 120 kilometers in, I ended up at a place called Bentley in Hampshire, which is quite close to Farnborough. And my bike broke, my valve came out, and I was like, oh wow, I don't know one thing about bikes. I'm like, what am I gonna do? And I was just like, I'm gonna pretend that I know, and I'm gonna, you know. And my phone didn't have signal. I was just like, fuck it, I'm just gonna try and do what I can. And I don't know, I bodged it without knowing what I was doing. And there was this woman, obviously I was in a very small village, so this woman just came up to me and she was like, are you in trouble? Like, you know, what's wrong with your bike and all that? And we got chatting, and she asked me about, have I done this before? And I was like, I've done a ride before, but I didn't have all the bags and stuff on my bike, so I'm not sure. And then she was like, where did you ride before this? And then I was like, oh, it was in the Himalayas in India. And she was like, oh, is that where you come from? How old are you? You don't look very old. I was like, I'm 18. I have only come to the country like, what, three, four? No, more than that. Yeah, like less than 6 months ago. And she's like, oh, do you know anyone here? And I was like, nope. She invited me in, and she was like, oh, I would love for you to chat with my daughter about all your adventures and all that. I was like, this is an adventure? Ooh, yay, okay then. And yeah, and I was kind of like, invited me in, gave me food, gave me tea, and we got chatting. Her daughter came, then her husband came, and she was like, do you want to stay over? And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I said that I got lost, which is why I ended up here. And I was kind of like, I wasn't planning on going across the country at this point. I was like, I'm just going to go on a 400 kilometer ride. And she said that, how about this? Like, my husband will give you this map and like tell us where you're going, sort of thing. And I was like, oh, that's where I'm going. And like, that was like, I looked at the map and I was like, what's the other end of the UK called? And it was like John of Groats, mainland UK's like other end. And I was like, okay, that's where I'm going. And I was like, dear, that's a long, long way away. Like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I'm sure. I will somehow make it. And then she was like, well, then you can keep the map. And then I said that my bike is broken and I had had a couple of crashes. So that was my first day of wearing clipped pedals. And I had already crashed a couple of times. I'd got stuff on my knee, there was blood on my shoes, and it was really weird. And like, they took me to Halfords, where got me all the stuff that I needed to fix the bike. The person there as well like fixed my bike and help me out. And I went to pay, and this guy just goes, no, you don't need to do that, like, we're hosting you, that's how it works here. And I was like, wow, I love British people. I don't, like, how did this happen, like, what? And yeah, took me back to his house so that we could start, and like, well, I could start. And then yeah, gave me packed lunch and all, and I left, and I was like, wow.
They gave you a packed lunch, that's so British.
Yeah. And that night, I went in a bus shelter. And I was like, I just sat there and was like, I don't have enough money to get into a hotel. I don't have enough money to, like, to get anywhere, really, right now. So I didn't have a sleeping bag at the time with me. Well, the one I had, I left in my house. I was like, I'm not going to need it, was what I thought. And I didn't carry a sleeping bag. I didn't have a bivy bag. I wasn't prepared. And it was April. And yeah, I was in the bus shelter wearing every single thing I owned because it was bloody cold. And I just, I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I remember I had a notepad with me and I decided I was gonna write something every day. And I remember clearly writing in that, I was like, this is shit. I am very cold and I feel very lonely. And yesterday I felt like I was with my family. And I would have never thought that now every time I miss my family, I visit them. Yeah, I'm still in touch with them. They're like good friends with me. And like every time I miss my family, like I visit them and I take something with me and we have a good chat and I stay over and all that.
That's so lovely.
Yeah, they're really good people. But yeah, and then that was kind of how the journey went, sleeping in bus shelters on the sides of the roads. And like, I think I also slept under a bridge where I was just like, I had a rain cover, so I just held it over me, but I would just like go like this and just crawl under something.
I think I must have hugely misunderstood. I'm waiting for the part where you tell me that you didn't have a sleeping bag, so you turned around and went home.
No, I didn't. I kept going. Oh, no. Turning around was not an option. Not at all. Because, you know, I had to know the country that I was going to live in. So I had to really understand how everything works. And it was so instilled in my brain that the only way I can really understand the British culture and how everything works over here is if I travel slow and travel across. That was like my motto at the time. But nobody knew this. It was in my head. Travel slow and travel across. And I knocked on random doors. Like, I've heard you're not supposed to do that in this country, but I hadn't heard it at the time. I would knock on random doors. And another incident which really sticks out is Bolton. So between Manchester and, it was near Rivington Reservoir. And there was a place called Bolton and there was this hall barn. And I remember I had managed to book myself in some very, very cheap place. And I asked people where it was because I couldn't find it on my maps. Everyone just guided me on the roads that didn't exist. And I was like, what is happening? And then I realized it was at just by the side of a motorway and there was no way on a bike I could go there. But I didn't realize it until next day. So anyway, I rode past Reservoir and there was this hill that I went past and my lights weren't working and it was dark and I really needed a wee. And I was just like, I was stressing out. And I was really panicking. And I reached on the top of the place. It felt like a climb, so it must have been one. I reached at the top of the hill and I saw there was a light on. And it looked like, I felt like I was in the middle of a horror movie at the time. Because it was just like, I don't know what's happening. My phone's almost dead. And like, what's happening with me? And I resorted to crying. I was just like, I was sitting the side of the road just crying. And then I saw there was this light on, like it suddenly flicked on in this really big hall barn, whatever. I didn't even know what that meant. And I went in there and I knocked and I was like, anybody there, help? And I was screaming for help. Like it was like right now. Now if I did that, I'm laughing at myself, actually. Like, it wasn't even a serious situation. I could have gone for a wee anywhere. And I could have, like, waited somewhere until it was daylight. Like, there were so many things I would do now that I didn't even know existed back then. And I think that's the beauty of it. Because anyway, these people opened the door and I was like, And I at that point, I was using whatever was left of my phone battery to call my dad and be like, I might be in trouble. And I was just like, I was just panicking and speaking with him. And then obviously the woman opened the door and I was like, do you have a toilet? And then I handed over the phone to her. And then my dad said something and she pointed me towards the toilet. And I was like, what am I doing? Am I an idiot? Am I an absolute idiot? And anyway, came back and she put the fire on. I sat near it. She gave me a couple of blankets. And as I said, I didn't have enough gear with me. So no cold, like cold weather clothes and all. And she gave me like a bunch of blankets and I sat there. And it was a day before Easter. Yeah, it was a day before Easter. And yeah, her and her husband were saying that there was no place where, like, you know, the one that you said, it doesn't exist. And I was like, are you sure? And then I showed her the booking and then she was like, darling, this place is right next to a motorway. How are you planning on getting there? I was like, okay, sorry. And then she was just like, and I stopped crying and calmed down. And then she asked me what I was doing and I was like, I'm riding to John O'Groats. And she asked me, and she said, like, I don't want to be rude, but where are you from? And I said, I'm from India. I'm new here. I've only recently moved. And then she's like, and then she looked, I think she looked at her husband and kind of said, that explains. Yeah, and then she was like, it's Easter tomorrow, and what the day after, I don't remember, but she was like, do you want to stay over because nothing's going to be open, basically. And I was like, I kind of thought for a little bit because they were asking me if they wanted me to, they were asking me if I wanted them to drop me to that motel place. And I said that if it's by a motorway, then I'd rather not because I have a bad experience with motorways. And and ended up, the way it happened, I saw a photo in their house and I was like, I think I recognize that, but I didn't say anything, right? And then when we started chatting more, the woman just asks me, do you know a film called Dangal? And I was like, yeah, I had auditioned for it. And then she was like, my daughter had casted in it. Like, she played the role of a German wrestler or something like that. And I was like, no way. And I was like, is that her? And I was like, and then she said, yeah, that's my daughter. She played a role in an Indian film. And I was like, holy shit, that's crazy. And the next day I got to meet her and when I told her that obviously I had auditioned for being the role that kind of fought her in the match, basically in the wrestling match in that film, we were kind of like, holy shit, small world, and like, who would have thought in the middle of here I would find someone that played a role in a Bollywood film or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was crazy. Like, I couldn't believe that happened. But her husband, he was Ukrainian, I think, and he looked at my stuff. I told, like, they asked me what I had with me. So I showed them, and they were like, this is not a lot for what you're doing. You have nothing else to wear? Like, you know, over this, like a down jacket? And I had no idea. Like, I was like, but it's April. The weather's not supposed to be that bad. And then they were like, darling, this is the UK. And I was like, okay, yeah, okay.
And you're about to reach Scotland.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They gave me tons of more, like, layers to wear. And I said to them that on my way down, I'll drop them. And they were like, they are all yours. And then, because this was, like, happening right in front of me, some of it was, like, properly new. Like, they were like, okay, and they took me to the closet and they were like, okay, does this fit you? Does this fit you? Does this fit you? Okay, take it all. And I was like, okay. I was like, what is happening with me? Why are people helping me so much? Is this normal? Do they think I'm homeless? Oh my God, they think I'm homeless. Oh no. And like, that was kind of what was going through my head. And yeah, from then, every other day, they would ask me where I was and if I was doing okay. And they were like, please, please, please let us know when you're back to Bournemouth. And
How long did it take you to get to John O'Groats?
Oh my God, like 2 to 3 weeks. It took me a long, long time. 2 to 3 weeks, it shouldn't take that long. But it took me that long because I didn't know what I was doing, did I? And then I got my roads wrong. And then when I thought, in Scotland, I would just stop at, I would see all the hills and then I would just drop my bike somewhere with the stuff and be like, oh, I feel like going up and down that hill, I'm gonna do that. And I would do really weird things like that. And yeah, I just wasted time. I was like, I was in no rush whatsoever. I just took my time.
But why rush?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things I really wanted to ask you about today, because we'll move on to the around the world ride in a sec. But I'm pleased you've said it before I've asked. You know, there's no time limit.
Yeah.
On riding to John O'Groats. Mm. And if you want to stop and walk up a hill, then...
Yeah, definitely.
Why not?
Yeah. People were so nice though. Like, even when I got to... There were several bits of A9, the last road, that I remember I would just sit at the side of the road and just lie down and just be like, oh, this is good. This is so good. And then someone would just stop and ask if I was okay. And someone would just give me a scone or something. And I was like, oh, what's this? And the first thought would enter was like, is that vegetarian? And then I would be like, V, stop being silly. Just eat it. But... yeah, and then eventually I reached John O'Groats and I was sitting there and I remember I was kind of like, holy shit, I actually made it. And I had no idea I was even going to come here. And I looked at the paper map and I had circled the place where the guy gave me the map. And, you know, the family, when they gave me a map, I circled that place on the map and I just looked, I was like, I cannot believe this happened. And yeah, it was crazy.
And like, inevitably, my next question is, how did you get home?
I took multiple trains. And bear in mind, I had never, 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 ever taken a train before in the UK.
Yeah.
By then, until then, well. So it was, I feel so dumb. But like, I kept asking the people at train station who are in fluorescence, what are they called? The people who work at train stations, well, the staff, that's what they're called. I kept asking the staff, I was like, where do I keep my bike? Will my bike be safe? It won't be stolen, will it? Obviously, I didn't know that you could, I don't think you could do e-tickets at the time, I'm not sure. Because I had like this big bunch of tickets to get from Wick to Bournemouth. And I was like, this is one ticket for my bike. This is a ticket for me. Ticket for my bike. Ticket for me. Then I have to change here. 7 minutes, 6 minutes, 4 minutes. What if the train gets late? And like, I kept asking all these questions. And the guy gave me this assistance card. You know, the one like that they give for disabled people in case they need assistance. He gave one to me because he thought I was a bit...
It's a pick of a journey, though. I went to Fort William. Well, I went to the Highlands when I was 16 on the train on my own. And, you know, it was a very alien... I mean, I had to walk across Glasgow and change trains.
Oh, yes! Yeah, yeah.
That was confusing.
Yeah. By now I know the road.
So then, it's so amazing. I mean, we've talked so much about stuff that I thought would just be the introduction to the podcast. But do you go from that journey to then deciding to cycle around the world? Where does the spark of the idea come from?
Well, it comes from the fact that, remember I said that during my journey to John O'Groats, I was reading, I didn't say that, but I was reading a lot. I felt lonely, I would just read on my Kindle, and I was reading Juliana Buring's This Road I Ride, and I kept thinking to myself every time I'd ride, I was like, man, do I have it in me to do something like that? I would so love to do something like that. And I kept thinking, and I was just like, I kept reading as well, and I really loved it. And when I was in John O'Groats, sitting there on the bench, and I was just like, oh, can I do it? And then I was just thinking to myself, I looked at everyone who has done it as well, and I was like, wow, they were like at least 30. And like, you know, well, they were at least 20. And like, can I do it? Like, do I have it in me? And then I was just, I kept thinking, and I was like, I said to myself that, look, you didn't know anything about this country and you rode across it and you didn't even need that much money. Maybe you can go around the world. And, you know, I somehow gave myself that permission to dream bigger than I was at the time. And yeah, that was when the idea came about. And that's when I still, the whole train journey, I was just like, do I want to? Like, you know, do I want to go that big? And then at the same time, I was like, I mean, it's an obvious progression. I know I can do this, I can do that. Like, it's fine. But yeah, I didn't tons of research when I was back. Looked at every single person. Well, not every single person. I missed out so many. But yeah, I looked at people who have done it before and I was like, man, I would so love to do it. And read a bunch of travelogues and I was like, oh, yeah, this is happening.
So what was the plan? What was the goal when you decided to set off and go? What was the goal?
It's quite ridiculous. I wanted to get around the world in 100 days. And I wanted to be the fastest woman to do it. I don't know what I'm saying as if I'm embarrassed about it, but I took 2 months extra to finish, so that's why my voice gets all low and I'm like, yeah, I was planning to do it in 100 days. Oh, God. Yeah.
But why? What, do you think you are embarrassed?
I mean, I'm not anymore, but, like, it's weird, you know? I was planning to do that journey in 100 days. It took me 2 more months. It took me 59 more days to actually finish. And until the halfway point, I was on target almost. Well, yeah. But yeah, that was the idea. Around the world in 100 days, becoming the fastest woman to do it. And I would still be 19 when I finish. And I thought that would be like a good thing. And I had trained for it. I trained my ass off for it. And I personally felt like I deserved it when I started because I had trained for it and all that, you know? But yeah.
I think that, you know, the detail of that journey and the full story is probably a different conversation for a different day. Yeah. Because we've spoken about so much. But I am really interested in what happened to you mentally and like where, you know, forgive the... Well, where the wheels came off kind of thing and what happened and how you felt about it. And like, can you give us the briefest overview of what your journey entailed and what the plan was?
So the plan was to cycle across Australia, New Zealand, Alaska, Canada, Portugal, Spain, France, Belgium, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Russia, Mongolia, China, and then back to Australia. How it actually happened was me leaving, and all of that in 100 days, including transit, averaging 200 miles per day. That was the plan. Now, the way it happened, I left a month later, over a month later than I had planned. And in the first few days, I had a severe case of, I don't know, stomach bug, to the point where I actually...
had a small accident.
Yes, on the bike. Yeah, it was bad. It was really bad. And I wasn't able to average what I'd planned. That was gone. And then I was able to actually average what I'd planned or more. And I really pushed it then. And I genuinely, like, the minute I started feeling better, I was like, I need to go for this. And I need to get my days back and all that. So I was really, really sprinting the second half of Australia. And I also wasted a couple of days trying to get a visa, which really didn't work. And I would now just say they were days wasted because I didn't get a visa. Went to New Zealand. New Zealand was amazing. That literally went by in a flash because it was only like, what, 500 and something kilometers. Did not get a visa for America. So ended up going to, like, directly flying to Vancouver. And even in the middle of that, I had an issue with the flight because I accidentally had booked myself on a flight with a transit in US, and you need a transit visa, and it was a non-refundable flight, and I was like, shit. But anyway, I booked another flight, went to Canada, and the section of Rockies, there were really, really bad forest fires. I had a lung infection there. Oh, shit. So I must say that on a climb, on the top of a climb near Joffrey Lakes, I literally collapsed. And that was pretty bad. But anyway, continued the journey. My journey along the prairies, like literally the end of Rockies and till my halfway point, which was in October, I was so fast. Like, I was lucky with the winds. I was lucky with the weather, and I felt good. I felt confident. I was like, and everything that had happened in the Rockies. So like, I didn't just have a lung infection. I also got chased by a bear, and like, I it's kind of like all of the worst things that I could think of had already happened, and I was kind of like in the prairies. I was like, nothing can go worse. Like, with that mindset that it cannot get any worse. So like, you know, I just have to get on and go fast. And by the time I was at my halfway point, I had done over 9,000 miles, obviously. 9,020 miles, that was it. And I had done it in 55 days. So I had averaged around 200 miles each day, if not a little less. And it was quite funny because I couldn't walk properly. I was like, holy shit, everything hurts. How am I doing this? Like, you know, what the fuck? And after the halfway point, I needed a Schengen visa. That was it. I got there fast, that was okay. But if I wanted to go anywhere after Canada, I was gonna need a visa. And Schengen visa, if you're in a country on a tourist visa, you cannot apply for a Schengen visa, basically. I was in Canada on a tourist visa. So I went from embassy to embassy, literally begging for a visa. And it took ages before Danish embassy said that they could give me one. And the guy literally took pity on me because he saw all the letters and all that. He saw that I had the documentation. And he also saw that I had already been to at least 10 embassies. So he literally, took pity on me. And the next day he gave me an appointment, which was on my birthday. I turned 20. On my birthday, I got my Schengen visa. From there until Halifax, weather was absolutely shit. And there was a catch. I couldn't, obviously, when you get a Schengen visa, you have to get it for a country of, the visa has to be from a country where you start your journey in the Schengen territory. And I couldn't start from Denmark. Like, my whole plan would go to shit if I started from Denmark. So I decided to start from Iceland because Danish embassy was also doing Iceland visas. And I was like, okay, then. Basically, flew to Iceland, got hit by a minibus that's what it was, in, like, the first 30 kilometers. I'm very lucky, what can I say? Came back, flew to Portugal. Like, touch Portugal ride was beautiful. It was really pretty. I loved it. Crossed into Spain, I think, in a couple of days. And second day in Spain, I decide I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go big. And I'm going to try and get all the days that were wasted back. And I'm going to do this right. You don't get an opportunity to ride around the world often. I've got it. I'm going to make the most out of it. That was my mindset. and I leave that evening. So I had already ridden a lot that day. I took a break, I had some dinner, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to ride through the night because I don't feel that shit yet. So that was the evening, basically. A couple of people on a motorbike rode past, pushed me off my bike, and they didn't push me off right away. They were waiting every now and then as I rode for me to kind of, they would overtake or something, and then I would pass, and then they would just stop, let me kind of go a little bit ahead, and they would come, and I was like, I feel stopped. And the thing is, I had kept my spot tracker off because I was very aware of people tracking me. I don't like being watched, and I don't like being judged at all, and I kept my spot tracker off, and that has raised questions, and I cared a lot about it after I was done, because people actually said, oh, your spot tracker was off, like, who knows if you even did it and all that. And now I'm like, oh, I don't care, I didn't do it to prove to anyone. But anyway, sorry for another day. Got pushed off the bike, and I rolled, and whilst I was rolling, I took my helmet strap off because I was like, okay, I'm gonna throw this helmet at that bastard. And I was like really angry, and I don't know what I was thinking. Took the helmet off, and I kind of got up, and the helmet just rolled off somewhere, and I got up, and the next thing I knew, there was like a knife right at my neck, and this guy holding like my hands like kind of behind, and I was like, whoa. And then this other guy, he lifted my bike up, and he was just going through all my stuff and just like pulling things out of the saddlebag, just like, you know, just taking things out and throwing them around. And I was like, what is wrong with them? And I remember I really, really, really noticed that knife. Like, I can like imagine it when I close my eyes. Like, it was properly long and really sharp, and it looked like a kitchen knife. I remember I was like, okay, right now, if I scream or move, there are chances the knife was actually going to go in, and I'm not going to let that happen. So I had to keep myself from doing anything stupid, and the only way to do that was to kind of distract myself. So I kept looking at the guy right ahead. He's doing all these things to my bag and yelling something at me or the guy behind me, whomever. And I was like, okay, how does he look? Does he resemble any Indian actor, like any Bollywood actor, any Hollywood actor? Like, does he resemble anyone? What else can I see? And I was like, ooh, there's a number plate on a motorbike. And I memorized the number plate. It started with a B, ended with a 6. And I was just like, if I remember the first and last digit, everything will be fine. And I was like, okay, that's going to be my mantra for now. I'm just going to keep repeating it until this ends or I die. And I kept repeating it to myself, and like, in the next thing I knew, kind of took the knife off and like just pushed me off. It felt like I fell down something, because I remember there was an impact on my head. I rolled over, then I rolled over again, and then there was another impact on my head, and then I don't remember anything. And then there was like a bike on me, literally. And my nose was bleeding, but I didn't know that until later. I think I was unconscious for a few hours. I might be wrong, but, you know, I think so. Who knows? I got up. I pushed my... I looked... Obviously, I knew the bike was on me, because even if I was unconscious, I could feel the thud, you know? And I reached for my frame bag, and I got my torch out. My head torch, and I was like, where the fuck am I? Like, what's happening? I don't remember anything. I was like, why am I here? What country am I in? And like, I didn't remember much. I took my bike, pushed it back up, and I saw my stuff was sprawled across the road, and I picked it. I was like, okay, what? Put it back on my bike. Obviously, the bags where they go, and everything in the bags and all that. saw what was missing, but I wouldn't remember if I even had it because I couldn't remember much at all. And I was like, so which way am I going, left or right? And I was just like, I just went in one way, which turned out to be the correct way. And I ended up at a gas station, and this guy, he saw me, and the minute he saw me, he knew something was wrong. He just shut down everything at the gas station, like put that out of service, you know, in Spanish, whatever it's called, the sign outside. And there was a motel and a cafeteria just like behind a little bit. He took me there and he kind of got me some coffee, and he was like, he said in Spanish something on the lines of, do you want to tell me what happened? And I said, literally, I have no idea. And then he said, do you have a phone? And I was like, oh, I do have a phone. And then I was wearing several layers, and always, I keep my passport and my phone and my biometric residence card in that. So it was still in there. So I took my phone out, and I was like, and then he was like, passcode. And I was like, I don't remember. But I don't know how, but he looked at the phone. He tried 0000, which was my password. It worked. Google Translate told him, I don't remember what's happened, but my head really hurts, and I think my nose, like, I touched my nose, it was bleeding, and it was like, okay. And then it was really hard talking to him because, like, I felt the language barrier. And a family overheard me saying a number to him, which was the number plate of the motorcycle. And yeah, that's kind of how it kind of turned out. Then they said, oh, that's a motorcycle. I was like, yes, motorcycle. And then I kept getting memories. I was like, motorcycle. Yeah, they pushed me off. Then there was a knife involved. And like, I kept talking after that, and I pieced it back together. And I was like, yes, this is what happened with me. And hospital and all that. And they said I shouldn't be riding anymore. They said I should be, it's not safe and all that. And I was like, oh God. I was kind of like, one opportunity. And my bike's still fine. It was thrown down, that thing. I got broken, the bike didn't. That's a sign that I need to continue. It was scratched, I'm not gonna lie, but I said it was not broken. So I just took it with me. I was like, you can't keep me in the hospital because I'm not going to stay. And I raised my voice. I told them that I'm not going to stay in the hospital. Went back and I went to the motel, and I think I spent like a day and a half or something there. And however shit the condition was, I got back on the bike. it was not great. I wasn't doing much distance at all. I was doing like between 100 kilometers and 100 miles, and then it's like it would gradually increase by a little bit every week or every day, no, every other day, something like that, every week, let's say. But yeah, that was what happened in Spain.
Yeah, and then I guess, you know, you finished in 158 days?
No, 159 days. But like, again, like by the time I was over the Spain incident and by the time my body was functioning again, it wasn't, it's still like all the way till I got to like Belgium or so, I still was really struggling with everything. But in Belgium, I rode my first 300 kilometer after the incident. And it took me 24 hours, which is a long, long, long time to do 300. Like, it doesn't take that long. It should take 16 hours maximum. And I was like, oh, like, I'm able to do this. I'm going to continue. And that was like, that was like a breakthrough. I was like, I'm out of the race. I'm not going to win anything. And I'm not going to get any record anymore. But I'm so grateful to be alive right now, because I've had tons of incidents where I could have been killed. Like, legit, the bear thing. I could have died getting hit by minibus. The weather was so crap, no vehicles could see me. I was lucky that the minibus hit me the way it did, and I fell the way I did because I didn't get injured too bad. well, I was shaken up a bit, but whatever. And then, like, finally, the big one, like, there was a knife at my neck. That's like, I could have definitely been killed, but I didn't. And I was so grateful to be alive. And I, when I was in Finland, I had an option to either take a flight back to India and just call it off, or continue through winter in Russia. So I continued through winter in Russia. Well, I only did halfway, but I only went to Lufa, which is not even halfway. But I would still like to say that I've winter cycled in Russia. Oh, people are so nice over there. I love it. And it was so fucking hard riding bike in the snow. But yeah, that was it. And then India and then back to the finish line.
I mean, I said before we started that I was probably going to ask you a couple of tough questions.
Yeah.
So, you know, take these at face value and be devil's advocate deliberately. Do you think you were naive before you left?
Definitely. I thought it was just going to be, like, I'm not going to lie, I don't think I respected the journey that much. I think I just left, I was reckless. I think I just left thinking it's going to be fine if I've trained for it. I had considered the threat, so I'm not going to lie, I'd made a contingency plan and all that, I'd made a risk assessment, I knew things could go wrong, but I didn't think it would go wrong to this extent somehow. And I was kind of like, it'll be fine, it's just around the corner. And that was like my mantra, harden the fuck up and it's just around the corner. And yeah, part of it was because I was kind of naive and I was thinking, I would definitely say that I didn't have that much respect for the actual journey and for the enormity of the adventure.
Okay, yeah, and I'm really interested in what's changed, because, you know, that's something like that's so transformative. Why did breaking a record or setting a record or doing something in a certain amount of time matter to you so much before you set off?
I think it was a lot about me wanting to, like, I wanted to leave a mark, if that makes sense. I wanted to leave my mark. I wanted to be someone. And I've read so many books of legendary people, and I remember I'd cycled from Bournemouth to Kendal to meet, like, Mark Beaumont and Sir Chris Bonington, and I remember I got, like, signed books from both of them, and I was kind of like, oh God, one day I'm going to be one of them. And I was like, I was so fixated on leaving my mark and being someone in this country, like, and I wanted to show that, hey, you know what, when I came here, I was nobody. Now I'm somebody. It sounds silly. It really sounds silly. But that was what was going through my head when I said that, right, I want to do it in 100 days and I want to, you know, that, all that.
I don't think that sounds silly at all.
But, yeah.
I think we're all on our own journey to working at home what we are, and identity is such an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, one of the things I've really learned from interviewing, I think we've done 45 or however many of these, is that lots of these people are seeking identity. Mm. We're all looking for our own version of that.
Yeah. That's why everyone wants to do first or fastest, because they would be the only ones who have done it at that extent.
Well, interestingly, I don't think everybody does want to be first or fastest. I think some people do.
Yeah, some people do, that's
true. Some people do, for sure. I mean, that was going to be my next question, and, you know, no wrong answer at all.
Mm.
Do you feel the same now about leaving marks? And
I think by doing the journey the way I did, and I think the whole leaving mark happened by me continuing from Spain rather than calling it off. But that wasn't the intention at all when I did it. I honestly thought if I hadn't continued riding at that point, I would have probably, gone in, like, a very, like, dark place. But I was 20, what did I know? 21 now. I still don't know much. I don't know. I do kind of, I want to leave a mark now, but by doing something for others.
And again, tricky question. I'm doing it deliberately now.
Yeah, that's
fine. Do you think that leaving a mark is a good motivation? Is it a healthy motivation?
It's unhealthy if that's the only motivation. And I don't think I'll ever come to a point where that will be my only motivation, because there's so many things that I want to do and there's so many things that I have got planned, and none of them are with the motivation of only leaving a mark or, you know, being the unique person who does big things. I don't know. Yeah, I think I have many other motivations behind taking a challenge on, and yeah, leaving a mark is never the only one. So.
Yeah. How was coming home? How was the finale? And
yeah, you know how I would love to say it was amazing, but when I finished, I finished on Christmas Eve, late in the evening. So on Christmas Day, obviously nothing was open, and the only people in Australia were me and my parents. And there wasn't like a big finish. It was just, oh, I finished. Oh shit, I rode around the world. And then the next day, basically, nothing was open. So me and my dad got really drunk. I had so many cocktails. Oh my God, wonderful. Anyway, but my UK visa expired by that time. Well, it didn't expire. It got cancelled because I was out of the country for too long. So that's one of the things that I now have to avoid doing, being out of the country for too long. I always need to make sure I come back and go back. So I had to go to India, and I really didn't, I wasn't having a great time. I went to India and I was staying in this really, really small flat with my mentor, because I was finding, like, at my parents' place, I was finding it really stressful. And I just wanted to be around my friends and, you know, I wanted to be in the UK, because somehow, like deep inside me, somehow, like I now call the UK as my home, and I did back then as well. So the whole journey I had spent imagining having this proper, like, you know, I don't know how to say it, but I really was imagining, you know, sleeping in my own bed in the student house. And, you know, I moved there from a very, like, I was living in a really bad house before that. And when I moved in with my best friend, and he played an important part in this expedition as well. He filmed me for some sections, so, which was really cool. And I think all I wanted to do was, like, you know, see him and the other friends. And I wanted to just, somehow I was like, I even said to my parents, I was like, can I just take you to the UK? But when I finished, I was in India for a month sorting out my UK visa, which turned out to be a super, super, super stressful process. Because when you have traveled to all these countries, suddenly questions are asked. And I had to do all sorts of medical tests. And I had to do another interview. And I had to I had to get back to uni, but, like, I had to pay the fee again. I had to do all the procedure again. Like
re-enroll.
Yeah, re-enroll. And that was quite stressful. There was so much to do. But, like, when I came to the UK, like, finally, I think that was awesome, because a couple, well, 3 or 4 of my friends came to the bus station. So I took a plane back home and then a bus from Heathrow to Bournemouth, and all of my friends were there, and I was like, wow, this happened. Like, and throughout the bus journey, I was like, are they going to be changed? Like, you know, what's going to happen when I get off the bus? And it just felt like I had never left. I felt like everything just picked up from where I'd left, and it was amazing. I really kind of enjoyed a few days of being, you know, in the place that I felt home was my home. But then it all kicked in. I was like, shit. So I've done all this and I don't know, like, what? I'm going back to uni? Like, what? What am I going to do with my life? And I went through a really weird patch where obviously I was freelance writing and stuff, but then I would just randomly decide to get a Schengen visa and go to Norway for a long distance hike and just wild camp and then come back. And then I would go to Switzerland like the following week and then somewhere else the following week and then just randomly go to Scotland. So like when I came back, I wasn't able to sit still at all. Like initially, yes, I was into the outdoors. I was into adventure and all that, but I would go to uni and, you know, do what you do when you go to uni. After I came back, I was like, I was going nuts. I just, you know, I was seeking more adventure somehow.
You know, we've not gone full circle. We've gone on this journey through this conversation. And you told me at the start about this, you know, young girl who was playing football and eating lunch on her own and probably not quite sure who she was.
Yeah.
And what she was. Do you think you've worked that out or are you still working on it?
I think I'm still working on it. And I mean, yeah, I'm still working on it. And I'm still working on, like, who I want to become and who I want to be known as and how I want to come across when I, you know, see people and when people see me, actually. And I think I'm still figuring it out. And I think everyone is still figuring it out, like, whatever age they are. And yeah, but like, you know, that's the good thing about it. It can change any time.
Where are you happiest?
Oh, on the bike. Actually, no. I'm happiest when there's like a fire and a wild camping. Like, I don't know. I've done several things where I just make fire and I just bivy on the side. And yeah, I feel the happiest there. Yeah, I think where there is a fire and there are friends, that's like a happy place. Fire and friends.
Yeah.
Like the ancient times.
Like the ancient times, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we've not had many 21-year-olds on the podcast, but I think it's fair to say that you've done your fair share of adventure and justified your place.
Yeah, a little bit. I've tried.
No, cool. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much for doing it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk, and you can find us and follow us on Instagram at theadventurepodcast. You can also keep up to date with Vedangi on Instagram and Twitter at Wheels and Words. The podcast is produced in association with Sidetrack magazine, so for an extra adventure fix, visit sidetrack.com. The podcast is produced and distributed by Pip Saunders and Alex Hall. And as always, please do head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They make a huge, huge difference.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.